From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, the New York Times, working with CBS, broke a story suggesting that Bush administration war planners left bunkers of hundreds of tons of explosives unguarded in post-Saddam Iraq. That material is now missing, much of it presumably in the hands of the enemy. Actually, there have been many documented accounts of plundered weapons dumps, so Republicans are suspicious of the timing. But whatever the case, the story has what's known in the biz as traction. Thus, the final week of campaign 2004 was, if not explosive, at least about explosives.
You owe America real answers about what happened, not just political attacks.
The senator is denigrating the action of our troops and commanders in the field without knowing the facts.
But the facts are obscured in the fog of election war. On Monday, NBC reported that its embeds arrived with the 101st Airborne Division at the site on April 10, 2003, and found no explosives. The White House held up the NBC story as Exhibit A in its defense. Not so fast, said NBC's Tom Brokaw on Tuesday.
For its part, the Bush campaign immediately pointed to our report as conclusive proof that the weapons had been removed before the Americans arrived. That is possible, but that is not what we reported.
From there, the story shifted from moment to moment. The explosives weren't there to begin with. The explosives were there, but were taken care of. Matt Drudge posted one Pentagon official's speculation that the Russians had taken them before the war. Fox News sided reliably with the administration. The other cable channels were all over the map. Then, an ABC affiliate in Minneapolis weighed in with video from April 18, 2003, of soldiers at a bunker breaking UN seals off boxes of explosives, but not securing the site.
Based on the descriptions of the material in question in the video that we brought you tonight, the explosives may or may not be the material, the explosives in question.
On Thursday, former Chief Weapons Inspector David Kaye viewed that footage and declared on CNN that those were official IAEA seals. Those boxes certainly held some of the missing explosives. But not so fast again. On Friday, a soldier took the podium at a Pentagon press conference and said he'd personally carted off tons of dangerous stuff. Whether, however, it was the material in question still isn't clear. Reporters were confused. Pentagon spokesman Lawrence Derita.
I get that. You guys really want the definitive answer, and so do we. The difference is that that takes understanding facts, and we have tried to uncover facts over the last week at a point after which many people thought they had the definitive answer, and we simply do not.
So Houston, or should I say Cleveland, since it's in a swing state, Cleveland, we have a problem. A big story on election eve we just don't have time to understand. Josh Marshall runs a widely read website that takes a critical line on Bush called TalkingPointsMemo.com. He's been following the story and coverage in excruciating detail. He joins us now. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It seems that depending on what channel you tune in, you can get whatever story you want.
You're quite right. If you listen to Fox, you are in just a different fact universe than if you read the New York Times. I think the difference is that Fox has a strong sense of editorially where they want to go. They want to side with the administration. And so their take on this has been fairly consistent throughout. MSNBC and CNN, I think, don't have that preordained flight path, as it were. And they have been buffeted by the different theories that have been thrown out by the administration, by the different news outlets, by the Kerry campaign. The process works if you look back 3 weeks out or a month out or 6 months out and say, you know, how did it all shake out? What did the facts end up being? The problem is, as the stories unfold over 24-hour news cycles, the side that is just throwing up all sorts of bogus stories and misinformation, they get as much play as the sort of the factual reporting that has already been done.
This has been a campaign in which a fact doesn't stay a fact for very long. And once a fact is disproved about somebody's record, for instance, it comes back again in the next speech and is reestablished again, only to be slammed down again. Is it possible, when it really matters, to actually nail this story down, or any story?
I think what you're saying is exactly right. And when I said that the cacophony of voices shakes out to a relatively accurate version of things, that doesn't excuse how bad the journalism often is in the short term. What is running right now on CNN and MSNBC and Fox, that is what is really important in terms of shaping people's understanding of what is happening.
The interview that follows the one that we're doing is about the strategy of the Bush-Cheney campaign to shoot the messenger, as it were. Do you think there's something of that at work in this case?
Oh, that's certainly the strategy. During the whole Lewinsky scandal, that was part of the strategy of the Clinton administration. They were looking at the people who were behind the story and trying to discredit it by discrediting the messengers. In this case, I think that strategy will be successful for the White House in reassuring their base voters. However, that's not really what the issue is in campaign terms. The issue is really swing voters, and I don't think that will be particularly persuasive to swing voters unless and until the White House has a factual argument, not just don't believe this because it's the New York Times and CBS, but here's why it's wrong.
One last question. Every issue, no matter how unrelated to the campaign, is now a campaign issue. That's the way it's reported in the majority of the stories. The stories about the details tend to be deeper in the papers or in sidebars. So what do you think? Do you think that the timing of the story couldn't be worse?
For the White House?
For the story.
Probably for the facts of the story coming out in as clear and as accurate a way as possible, it is not good timing for the story. If this had happened a year ago, the tension in the air and the need to get the story right quickly would not be there. On the other hand, if the story is true, it is more relevant for it to be known to the public before the election than after the election. So I think it sort of depends on the standard by which you judge it.
Josh, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Josh Marshall writes for The Washington Monthly and The Hill. He's also the author of the blog TalkingPointsMemo.com.
This week, the New Republic magazine's Ryan Lizza broke down what he calls a four-part Bush campaign endgame. Phase one, go on attack. Phase two, roll back time to 9/11. Phase three, soften the president's image. And phase four, kill the messenger. To get that job done, Lizza says, the Bush campaign is using an old tactic in a new way.
Well, what I find interesting about this final stretch is that the RNC, they regularly send out what's known in the business as opposition research about political opponents. So every day in our mailboxes, reporters covering the campaign get a release with a sort of unflattering picture of John Kerry at the top and, you know, a list of negative information about him. And that, of course, goes on in every campaign. This is the first time I can remember where they're sending out the same kind of stuff about specific reporters.
Who has been targeted?
The first one I got was during the debates, when they went after Chris Matthews. They didn't like the way that Matthews referred to Cheney's comments about tying Saddam to 9/11. Chris Matthews basically said that Cheney was wrong in the debate when he said he's never done that. The RNC sort of blew a gasket over this and sent out a lengthy rebuttal mentioning the fact that Chris Matthews is a Democrat because he used to work for Tip O'Neill. It's kind of ironic, actually, because of all the TV pundits the night of the vice presidential debate, that's when this happened, Chris Matthews was one of the only ones that's saying Cheney sort of cleaned Edwards' clock.
Another RNC emailing went after Ron Suskind after he had a piece in the New York Times magazine examining the president's faith and its role in his presidency. Tell me about that.
They didn't like that one much at all. And this was the first one where they included one of those unflattering pictures like they usually do with their political opponents. So they had a sort of dopey-looking picture of Suskind, where he's got his eyes sort of half-closed. They actually looked up his party registration and found out that he's a registered Democrat, and they pointed that out. They tried to discredit this story by claiming that Suskind is too much of a political partisan.
The headline said, Liberal Democrat Suskind has creativity but not facts. And the headline on the release about Chris Matthews said, Democrat Chris Matthews, selective analysis.
That's right.
Well, fair's fair. Chris Matthews was a staffer for the Democratic Speaker of the House, and Suskind is a Democrat, presumably a liberal one.
Right.
So is it unfair for the Republican National Committee to kind of provide context for these guys' journalistic efforts?
I think what matters more than someone's party affiliation or sort of someone's personal ideological leanings is the content of what they write and say. granted, they did take issue with specifics in all these cases. They challenged the facts in the pieces as well as making a sort of somewhat personal attack. On the left, you find the same thing. You find a lot of bloggers and a lot of liberals who this cycle are attacking mainstream journalists, accusing them of bias. And I think overall what people on both sides, the effect is to sort of polarize the press or politicize the press. And there aren't a whole lot of media institutions that are seen as down the middle and fair these days, because both sides seem to have an interest in painting the traditional media institutions as somewhat partisan.
I also noticed that they seem to be using attacks on the press as the ultimate get-out-of-jail-free. When newspapers started doing more fact-checking of assertions made in campaign advertising and in the debates and on the stump, a leading Republican was quoted as saying he didn't think that the president and Vice President Cheney should be subject to reflexive criticism from the press. What was that all about?
That was a comment from Steve Schmidt, a spokesman for the Bush-Cheney campaign, made to Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post, who was writing a piece about this subject. And what's remarkable about that to me is it sort of tells you what the White House and the Bush campaign's view is of the press. What they would like and what they've worked hard to accomplish is for the press to basically be an unmediated receptacle for their message on a daily basis. And if the press suddenly concerns itself with fact-checking that message every day, that doesn't sit so well with the White House or the Bush campaign. I think, actually, the White House has been very good at using the press to get their message out relatively cleanly without a whole lot of fact-checking. That's changed in this campaign. I think part of the reason it's changed is because, for a while, Bush didn't really have a political opposition. But with an opponent, you have the other side pointing out factual errors in the White House and the president's statements. So there's a lot more pressure for the press to be watchdogs, a lot more pressure for them to fact-check what the president's saying. So I think they got away with a lot in the first couple of years. They've gotten away with a lot less since Bush has had a serious opponent.
Okay, well, Ryan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ryan Lizza is a senior editor for The New Republic. We found him on the campaign trail in Toledo, Ohio.
Coming up, the politics of traffic reports and what George Bush and Al Gore have in common. Negative Election Eve Press.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Historians looking back at October of 04 might remember it as the month of the sweep. Not only the 4-0 triumph of the Boston Red Sox, but also the 3-for-3 performance of John Kerry in the presidential debates. Those historians need only glance at the headlines. A new study finds that in the first 2 weeks of October, more than half of the mainstream news stories about candidate Bush, and not just about the debates, were negative in tone, compared to only a quarter of candidate Kerry's. And the study noted that this was a mirror image of the closing weeks of the last presidential election, when Bush received twice as much positive coverage as Al Gore. Tom Rosensteel is the director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which conducted the study, and he joins me now. Tom, welcome back.
My pleasure.
So, first of all, how did you determine what was negative as opposed to what was positive press coverage?
For a story to be clearly negative, the critical or unfavorable assertions in that story had to outnumber the positive assertions about a candidate in that story by 2-1. Also, the stories had to be about a candidate. It couldn't be a story about, you know, the electoral process or,
right,
you know, voter habits. These were stories that were focused on a particular candidate or were comparative about the two candidates together.
Now, when you talk about assertions, do you mean statements of fact?
No. What we mean is either quotations that are from sources or the narrative from the author of the piece that are making judgments, such as, the White House was scrambling to put the pieces together all day today after a poor debate performance last night.
Mm-hmm.
That's an assertion that has some interpretive or judgmental sense of it.
Let's take your example. The White House is scrambling after the president's poor performance in the debate. Now, the poll suggested that the president gave a poor performance in the debate. Is that then interpretive or is that a statement of fact?
Well, if the statement that the polls showed that the majority of people didn't believe that the president won the debate, that would be a statement of fact. But the story I'm thinking of said the President Bush signed a tax bill into law today, blah, 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 blah. But behind the scenes, the White House was scrambling to recover from a poor debate performance. So those were choices that the reporter made, and they were not descriptive of events. They were actually descriptive of a sort of a context in which he was trying to put the events.
I wonder why you frame your study in terms of negative and positive coverage. Is it possible that these categories obscure the bigger picture about what's really important in reporting, whether it's true, whether it's contextualized? Negative versus positive may not be very meaningful.
Well, that's only one of about eight variables that the study looks at. It's something, however, that there's a growing interest in, and it's easy to do, and I think more relevant to do in terms of a debate period, because you do want to kind of get a sense of who prevailed in the coverage around this time. And frankly, I think the fact that Gore's coverage and Bush's coverage are such exact mirror images of each other tell us something surprising and interesting, which is that what happened to Gore 4 years ago happened to Bush this time, and it changed the race 4 years ago, and it's going to change the race this time.
But last time around, Gore was called a liar for inconsequential exaggerations. He was called a liar for things he didn't actually say, such as being the model for the protagonist in Love Story and so on. These were unfounded, snarky observations that were made by the media all the time. And it may add up to the same negativity numbers, but it doesn't mean the same thing happened.
Brooke, what we're looking at now is just the debate phase and the fates of these two candidates who were perceived to have gotten the worst of the debates. That's where the parallels in behavior are. But, you know, I have to tell you that conservatives think that the press has it out for the president just the way that a lot of Democrats thought the press had it out for Gore 4 years ago.
I guess I just really like to see a study done every 4 years about which candidate is being treated fairly and which candidate is being treated unfairly rather than negatively and positively.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you're ultimately you want to try and get a sense of. The problem is what's fair is so hard to get your hands on that it becomes a cumulative judgment. Tone becomes a component of fairness, but it doesn't get you the full picture.
Why do you think we're seeing more negative coverage of Bush now?
In an environment where the press is often being accused of bias, and when the race is confusing and mixed up, the debates, and particularly these debates, where clearly Kerry performed better, were a moment when everybody could agree on something, and there was a sort of rush to a consensus. I think another reason is that the press coverage in general has become more interpretive over the years. Reporters, particularly covering politics, feel freer to, you know, interpret and even make judgments in their stories. Only 14% of the stories in this year's study were straight news, that old inverted pyramid style. Whereas 4 years ago, we saw in the same time period, twice as many, 29% of the stories were this sort of straight news just describing the events of the day. We're not suggesting that this is appropriate or inappropriate.
I got a clear sense from the remarks that accompanied the report that you didn't think interpretive reporting was very good.
Well, I know why editors believe that their coverage needs to be more interpretive than it used to be. In the age of 24-hour news and the internet and satellites and cable, facts, mere facts, are considered common commodity. And your newspaper the next morning, your evening newscast that night, has to do something more than recite the facts that people may already know. But I also believe that in an atmosphere where charges of bias are a lot more rampant than there used to be, you know, these things are not so simple. Interpretive reporting is in some ways a higher form of reporting, but it's also a riskier form of reporting.
Tom, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tom Rosensteel directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which has just released a new report on campaign coverage in the first 2 weeks of October.
In January, we spoke with Brooks Jackson, the ex-CNN correspondent and mastermind behind the Annenberg Public Policy Center's factcheck.org. Nice idea, we thought, fact-checking political ads and political speech with a view to holding the polls accountable for their distortions. But now the campaign is over, and we wondered if the site had any impact on the volume of lies generated by Campaign 2004 or even the public's awareness of them. Brooks, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, Bob.
Is it my imagination that for all of the fact-checking and truth-squatting and integrating fact-checking within the bodies of news stories on page one, that the last few days and weeks have actually seen an increase in, shall we say, the incautiousness of the campaigns?
Oh, I think that's inevitable, and you'll always see the pitch sort of steps up in the last week of a campaign. We've seen an ad from the Bush campaign featuring a pack of hungry wolves, sort of symbolic of Al-Qaeda, I suppose, blaming Kerry for voting for cuts in intelligence spending that would leave us vulnerable. And we've seen an ad from an independent pro-Kerry group that questions whether the draft is going to be reinstated because of Bush's policies in Iraq. So there you have it. I mean, if you believe the ads, the choices in this election are between being devoured by wild animals or having your loved ones conscripted and sent off to a war zone.
Let's talk about the wolves for a moment, because I think that is a nice window into the technique of the political consultants who craft these things. It states that Kerry voted against a certain appropriation after the attack on the World Trade Center. And there are two interesting facts that qualify that. First, the attack that it refers to was the 1993 attack, not 9/11. And secondly, Kerry took a position on that bill that was identical to that which then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney had taken with the Congress. But all of that context is absent.
Well, the ad is careful to state that Kerry's vote, the one they're referring to, came after the first terrorist attack. But many people hear that as the first attack on the World Trade Center tower in 2001. I've talked to journalists who are surprised when I point out to them that they're talking about the truck bomb that went off in the basement of one of the World Trade Center buildings in 1993. If you don't listen very carefully, you can be misled. I know that for a fact. The ad also says that Kerry supported a $6 billion cut in intelligence, slashing, I think is the word they use. The fact is, when you lay it out and look at it, he voted for and actually sponsored a deficit reduction measure that included a $1 billion cut in intelligence spending in 1994, followed by a four-year freeze in spending at the same level, adjusted upward for inflation. And to put it further in context, we were spending an estimated $27 billion on intelligence overall at the time, so it represented about something under a 4% cut. I think a journalist would not call that slashing, a journalist would call that trimming.
Kerry, only a couple of weeks ago, had an ad out that lied blatantly about the president's plans for Social Security. And I use the word lied advisedly. You don't seem to use it much on factcheck.org, but don't you regard, as I do, the assembly of nominal facts to create a misimpression as fundamentally a lie?
Well, to me, a lie means an intentional and knowing falsehood. And since I don't know what they know, I'm not a mind reader, I guess I give them the benefit of the doubt. You're right. We haven't used the word lie to characterize anything a candidate's said on our website. We use terms like distortion and misleading statements, statements out of context, not the whole story. False, if they are false, and we think we can prove it. But a lie, I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. Maybe they actually believe some of this stuff or all of this stuff that they're saying. And in a way, that would be kind of scarier than if they're lying, because one of these guys is going to be elected. And if they really believe all the bogus information that they're putting out, it doesn't bode well for the next 4 years.
Not to be too dispiriting or anything, but on the question of what effect this has on the electorate itself, the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland released a poll that found that a majority of Bush supporters, 72%, believe that Iraq possessed prohibited weapons or had a major weapon of mass destruction program. So, do you despair for the significance of your work when clearly, at least with this group, you're not getting through?
No, I don't despair. I just think that we've been, as journalists, outclassed by those who would spin us, whether they're elected officials or people seeking elective office or special interest groups. The world's just gotten to be, every year that I've been alive, a more complicated and bewildering place. And I don't think journalists' skills and the dedication of their bosses has kept up with the need to explain this world to our audiences.
Brooks, thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here, Bob.
Brooks Jackson is director of FactCheck.org, a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania.
In this closing week of the campaign, swing state voters have been swamped with phone calls, mailers, billboards, print TV, and radio ads in a last-ditch attempt to, in the parlance of the day, close the sale. The Bush campaign has found a new way to reach the masses, sponsoring local radio traffic reports. Now in many markets, news of the three-car pileup causing the backup on the interstate is brought to you by Bush Cheney 04. OTM's Paul Ingalls has more from the swing state of New Mexico.
105.1 The Range. It's Misty Miles with the Morning Stampede.
We have a new rollover wreck, I-25 near San Felipe. Both directions are going to slow down because of it.
If you commute, traffic reports have long been must-hear radio. Get early word of a tie-up and chances are you can avoid the delay. And advertisers know that traffic reports are turned up and tuned in by listeners, so they've hopped on board as sponsors, getting a 10-second live spot at the end of each update.
This report is the service of Sonic. Drive in for the new double patty melt toaster sandwich. Two delicious all-beef patties and your choice of smoky cheddar or pepper jack cheese with grilled onions served on Sonic's thick Texas toast.
Along with fast food menus, new car deals, and department store sales, in recent weeks, traffic report listeners in six swing states have heard from a new sponsor.
This traffic report is paid for by Bush Cheney 04 Inc. Just 1 year after the first World Trade Center attack, John Kerry proposed slashing America's intelligence operations by $6 billion, which would have weakened our defenses. President Bush approved this message. I'm Misty Miles. There's your morning stampede on 105.1 The Range.
One of the great things about this particular way of advertising is it breaks through a lot of the clutter.
Kevin Madden is a spokesperson for the Bush Cheney campaign. He says the ticket is sponsoring traffic reports in Florida, Nevada, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and here in New Mexico.
You tune in and you listen to the message and you take that message with you. So it's a very unique form since it's never been done in a presidential campaign to our knowledge, and it's a very effective form of advertising.
Personally, I think it's a brilliant idea.
Rick Frischman runs a PR firm in New York called Planned TV Arts. He also worked in radio for many years and wrote a book titled Guerrilla Publicity. Frischman personally crawls through big city traffic 4 hours a day and thinks the traffic report messengers lend some credibility to the political message.
Yeah, a lot of these guys have been on the air for like 30 years, and they have saved our rears so many times that these are the guys we're tuning in for. So if he reads some copy afterwards, it's a political ad, I sort of trust him. It's almost subliminal. It's so short. As I'm driving, listening to traffic, and then, by the way, I just heard, you know, Kerry slammed, and I didn't even realize it.
That may be because the same voice giving the traffic news slides right into a live read of the Bush ad. That's how Metro Networks does all their spots. Metro is the Westwood One company that provides local news, traffic, and sports reports for over 2,000 radio stations nationwide. In order to do the messages live and skip the rule requiring that the candidate's voice approve the message, Metro appealed to the Federal Elections Commission for a waiver. FEC Chairman Bradley Smith wrote the advisory that cleared the path for Metro to have its way.
One of the keys to this opinion is that traffic reporters are often flying above the traffic and broadcasting live, and they simply don't have the ability either to have the candidate there with them to make the speech or even to plug in a little tape to do it.
Not all Metro reporters do their updates while flying or driving. Many are in a local office or a radio station. Still, Metro's applying the waiver to all their traffic reporters. Although the Kerry Edwards campaign has so far passed on traffic sponsorships, spokesperson Laura Capps insists that her side is keeping pace on the radio.
We're reaching out just as in many creative ways as they are. We have a lot of celebrities that are calling into pop radio. Sheryl Crow's doing that today for us in Nevada, for example. We have celebrities who have recorded PSAs that just remind people to vote, and we think that's really the important. We know that it's just about getting people to the polls, and we'll be victorious if we do that effectively.
If the onslaught of advertising doesn't sour some voters so completely that they stay home election day. With virtually every commercial break loaded with national and local political attack ads, and now many traffic reports getting the Bush-Cheney tag, Even the disc jockeys, who have to hear every one of these spots, are admitting to political fatigue. Bobby Box, morning man at Albuquerque's oldie station KABG, got honest with his listeners last week.
We're proud of our advertisers. You know, I know it's getting a little old. You know, I approve this commercial line, but still, what are we going to do? Every 4 years? I think we can live with it just a little longer. And then, voila, it's over. Magic, it's gone. It disappeared. Just like The Illusionist does. I'm talking about David Copperfield. We have a pair of tickets for that show coming up.
One can only hope Tuesday's voting rolls out as smoothly as that segue from Bobby Box. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls in Albuquerque.
Stay there. We love you. Here's Frank Sinatra from Big 98.5.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances.
Coming up, two kinds of Fright Night. One has vampires, the other,
yeah, exit polls.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This year, on election night, the networks will debut a new apparatus for their poll results. It's called the National Election Pool, and it has risen from the ashes of the Voter News Service, or VNS, which led Dan Rather to call Florida for Gore with absolute and, as it turned out, ludicrous certainty.
The networks were confident because they relied on two kinds of information: exit polls, which offer a snapshot of voting patterns and act as a predictor, and the actual vote count, announced by officials at individual polling districts after the polls had closed. Associated Press reporters across the country collected the vote counts and turned them over to VNS experts, who then tallied the numbers and fed their results to the networks, which is why the media weren't entirely to blame for what went wrong. The Florida exit polls were off, partly because the ballot was so confusing, some people really didn't know for whom they had voted. And the actual vote count was also wrong, because the officials who fed the numbers to reporters were confused, too. That's according to Jonathan Storm, who is covering this year's election night planning for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
What people didn't realize was how wrong the elected officials can be. Not for any nefarious reason, just because they're not infallible. And a lot of the numbers in Florida were just flat wrong. Combine that with a close vote count, and you have a disaster.
There was also talk of an undercounting by the VNS of the absentee vote and other methodological problems that skewed the results.
The number of early voters has increased dramatically. And the VNS last time did three polls in California, Oregon, and Washington before the election to see what early voters would be doing. This year they've done it in 13 states, so that should help. It's very difficult to completely damn the VNS because for 40 years they did it fine. The thing that was being studied became much more fine than what people had expected. And the apparatus that was designed to study it was simply not up to the delicacy of the vote count.
So this new consortium, the National Election Pool, apart from doing more polls of early voters, what will it be doing differently than VNS to avoid the same sort of problems we saw 4 years ago?
They've found areas where vote counts go wrong. If you had a vote count in 2000, and the vote count for that same precinct is X or Y, lower or higher, then they're immediately aware that that could be a problem. In 2000, they weren't aware of that sort of thing. Another big difference this time is that all of the figures are going to be made available to everyone. You're going to be able to see immediately, because all the figures are available, if there's something going wrong. The problem is when you're counting millions and millions of individual actions, you will not have a correct number ever. Take 250 pennies, throw them on the floor, count them quickly, and I'll bet you $10 you don't get to 250.
Worst case scenario, I'm out 750. Who's behind the national election pool? The names of the principals seem awfully familiar.
The national election pool is actually ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, and the Associated Press. And then they've gone out and hired Warren Mitofsky, who's the head of Mitofsky International, and Joe Lenski, who is the co-founder of Edison Media Research. Polling in general, it's a small world. And both of them were there at the beginning of the formation of the Voter News Service in the early 90s. Mitofsky actually helped to invent political exit polling in 1967 in Kentucky. A buddy of his suggested that since guys who make movies get really good data from people coming out of theaters, that maybe guys counting votes could do the same thing with people coming out of election polls.
Last time around, the pressure the networks felt to call Florida first seemed to hasten their calls on what obviously was a very tight race. In the end, does it matter how good the data are if the networks misinterpret the margin of error and dive in with statistically dubious calls?
No. The networks aren't, at least that's what they all say, they aren't going to be falling over themselves to be first. In fact, David Borman, who's the Washington bureau chief for CNN and who's in charge of this election coverage, has said that people are not going to want to be first. They're going to prefer being somewhere in the middle. If someone's wrong, they don't want to be the first to be wrong.
Last time, they all promised the utmost of restraint, and Dan rather famously talked about if you hear it here, you can take it to the bank, but
there was a big run on the bank, and it failed. The entire credibility of the profession is really in kind of swampy ground right now, and I think these guys know it, and I hope that they will be careful. The other thing that I hope that they don't do is go on for hours and hours and hours, as Rather did in 2000, saying, we are very careful. Look how careful we are. We are so careful. Because that's just going to put people to sleep.
So what does that mean? Now, does it mean that switching from VNS to National Election Pool and a new methodology is all just sort of futile and that they may as well just break out the chili and have a drink and just wait for the official results to come in Wednesday or Thursday?
You've got to try. The difference, I think, this time is you've got a billion lawyers, you've got Democrats and Republicans there to challenge every vote. All of that stuff, I think, is going to add up to the fact that you're not going to have an idea in the world of who won this election, even on early Wednesday.
All right. Well, Jonathan, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jonathan Storm is a reporter and television critic at the Philadelphia Inquirer.
And now for a few of your letters. C. Anderson of Chapel Hill, North Carolina writes, I have listened to your program through the course of the current presidential campaign and find your evaluation to be amazingly slanted toward the Democrat Party candidates. Most of the media tend to give Mr. Kerry and his wife a free pass on a variety of issues. Most recently, those issues include his newly found faith, his just-before-election love of guns and hunting, and his party's determination to call out lesbian members of his opponents' families. I don't hear you calling the media on their light coverage of these strange directional changes.
Listener Michael Pettengill of Merrimack, New Hampshire, said OTM followed the media pack last week by insulting undecided voters. Here's how he sees the situation. Quote, I have the choice of burger joints that sell either beef or chicken, but I'm a vegan. Do I go down the tracks behind the burger joints and collect some collard greens, pick either the chicken or beef burger based on the amount of lettuce and tomato, or just skip eating? I think half the voters decide to skip eating.
And we have a couple of corrections. The first is from NPR's religion reporter Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She writes, "Your interview with Bob Case of the Evangelical World Journalism Institute implied that I am associated with WJI. That is wrong. I had agreed to teach a one-day class on radio reporting, but when I realized WJI is affiliated with the conservative World Magazine, I immediately pulled out. Unfortunately, WJI had already posted my name on its website as a faculty member. The blog world had a field day with that, but NPR's news managers stood behind me every step of the way."
The second error. On last week's show, in an interview about newspaper endorsements, our guest Joe Strupp described an endorsement dispute between an editorial board and a publisher. The dispute took place at the Oregonian, not at the Seattle Times, as was said in our interview. Our apologies to the Times.
Thanks for keeping us honest, if not balanced. Keep your comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Halloween arrives this weekend, even though for roughly half the country, this year Fright Night actually occurs on Tuesday. But we thought we would end this show with a look back at a simpler time, when TV news wasn't providing most of the scares. From the 50s through the mid-70s, dozens of markets aired local weekly horror movie shows, each featuring their own uniquely crafted campy host. Performers with names like Jeepers Creepers, Sir Graves Ghastly, and Dr. Shock all became local legends. OTM's Rex Doan recalls some of the greats of that lost genre and says, "Fangs for the memories."
As a child growing up in Northeast Ohio, Michael Weldon became addicted to monster movies. By his own admission, this consuming passion eventually rendered him unfit for conventional employment.
Yes. Since early childhood, I was really obsessed by horror movies. You know, my schoolwork suffered, it's true, but I became a film fanatic.
In fact, Weldon became one of the leading authorities on fringe films. Psychotronic, Weldon's movie magazine, along with the Psychotronic Encyclopedia of Film, are considered to be indispensable by movie mavens with a taste for the unusual. For Weldon and his many readers, entry into the weird world of monster movies began under the tutelage of their local shock theater program.
For the most part, the TV horror movie host phenomena started in the late 50s. Reason that happened was that packages of old horror movies were released to local stations all over the country, and they decided to create horror movie hosts locally. And Zachary, by far, was the most famous and most successful of the late 50s horror hosts.
Jonas, we'll turn off the radio. I can't stand that music there.
Horror hosts like Zachary in New York and the dozens of others working in smaller local markets not only invigorated late-night television, they single-handedly reintroduced important and influential films like Dracula, Frankenstein, and The Invisible Man to a whole new generation. But as Michael Weldon is quick to note, there was never a shortage of trash.
Even the original shock theater package that some people like to remember as all classic films was only partially classic films. They were padded with really mediocre ones and ones that had nothing to do with horror.
We've got some bad movies here at Channel 7, but that one's one of the worst.
Part of the reason why most of the horror movie hosts got into making fun of the movies, because a certain percentage of them really were bad.
I wish I didn't have to say it, but we have a film this evening called Horror Island. It's on an island, and it's pretty horrible.
The cheap props Zach used during his intermission breaks only added to the mood.
I think for hearts, we used a big hunk of liver, and we'd have it jumping up and down on the table in front of us. And my brains, of course, were cauliflower, and the nerves were spaghetti.
You also had a giant amoeba, didn't you?
Giant amoeba, my Lord, I almost forgot that. Yes, I was having dinner in a diner one night. And we ordered Jell-O, and the guy drags this big tray of Jell-O out and slices it up and hands it to us. And I'm saying, my Lord, why don't we try that? So I made a bucket of Jell-O and took it into the studio, and it looked horrible. It really looked horrible.
Yes, my dear, I hear. Yes. I'm just sewing up the old amoeba here. It'll heal properly, and who knows, maybe something will come of it.
With his popularity continually on the rise, Zachary even made a run at the Oval Office.
Yeah, the slogan was, put a vampire on the White House just for fun.
Despite his failed presidential bid, Zachary did hit the top 10 in 1958 with his hit record, Dinner with Drac.
A dinner was served for three at Dracula's house by the sea. The Wolfman was there, the monster was there, and the only normal person was me.
In 1960, some New Orleans musicians cut a record in honor of their own local horror host, Morgus the Magnificent.
Saturday night, when I go for my date, my baby and I just sit and wait for
Morgus the Magnificent.
Morgus Presents first aired in 1959 and ran on and off for 12 years, including a brief comeback in 1987. Eager to return again to television, Morgus still awaits for the big call. Can I speak to Dr. Morgus, please?
This is Dr. Morgus. By the way, who is this?
This is Rex Doane. I'm calling with the National Public Radio show On the Media.
Oh, that's right. Well, they told me you might be calling here. By the way, where are you located?
We're in New York.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'd love to go up there. One day I'll be invited to one of the big science symposiums. they'll be knowing more about me very shortly, I'm sure.
Good evening. Welcome to Morgus Presents.
Like a reality show. In fact, we were the first to do reality shows. We started in 1959, would you believe?
But reality was something that Cleveland's fabled horror host Goulardi never seemed to really grasp.
Here we are. And this is, I thought, you saw this a couple of times. That's a Ghoul Katir. G-O-U. L-E-Y. Why? Because you're sick. That's why.
With raunchy R&B records blasting in the background, exploding fireworks, and his own cryptic commentary, Goulardi achieved a level of anarchic reverie rarely seen on television. Michael Weldon.
Goulardi was using the sort of beatnik sick humor that was around at the time, which was very negative. Sometimes funny, sometimes in bad taste.
Goulardi plays nothing but poker. See, what you do in poker, you get a girl, and you poke her.
To the chagrin of his teenage viewers, and to the delight of the local PTA, Goulardi left Cleveland in 1966 to embark on a long and profitable voiceover career in Los Angeles. Eventually, syndicated sitcoms, late-night talk shows, music video programs, and infomercials began to compete for the after-hours TV audience. By the 1980s, horror show hosts became an endangered species, and, as Michael Weldon notes, everything else about local television began to change, too.
Today, we're missing out on the sense of community that went along with local television programming. Every local station throughout the country had their own talk shows and kiddie shows and movie shows and quiz shows, and I think the loss of these shows was a bigger deal than people realize.
Happily, there is some hope on the TV horror host front, but you may have to travel to find it.
Cleveland currently has three rival horror show hosts, all deriving from the Goulardi show. So it seems like Cleveland's television is in a time warp, which I think is wonderful.
Okay. Goulardi says come back. We'll see you next week. Be good. Stay sick.
For On the Media, in New York, I'm Rex Doane.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.